So Nia, the Makbuz It Happens.
In his work, Swiss artist Christoph Dräger uses video, installation, photography, and constant nods to the language of Hollywood and the mass media, which he dissects with a critical gaze and a spirit of reflection. Dräger describes his work as an analysis of the way we respond to and interact with the media. To this end, his main vehicle is disaster. Natural catastrophes, wars, and other tragedies as paradigmatic examples of contemporary media hype. The tools of media coverage, its implications, the ephemeral nature of disasters which are exploited and quickly replaced by a new event, always more shocking than the last. We are consuming disasters, Dräger says. Disasters are by far what gets the most attention in the media. People are almost hooked on live disasters. His pieces use archival footage and material that he produces himself, often reenacting events, reproducing fragments of films, or manipulating existing documents in order to emphasize, exaggerate, and point out key aspects in the complex web that makes up our notion of the world, which, in the digital era, is inextricable from information networks. As Dräger says, reality, reenactment, live footage, TV, and a certain degree of fiction are all intertwined. Sania talks to Christoph Dräger about surveillance, copies and originals, critical distance, reenactments, layers of meanings, and provocation.
Well, I'm very interested in processes of how we conceive media, and I think disasters are a very big part of the media. So that's why I am interested to work with disasters, because that's by far what gets the most attention in the media. Like, people are almost hooked on, you know, live disasters or disasters reported in TV and in other media, of course, as well. So this is something that I think is very important for society, but it's also something that is very short-lived. So, like, one disaster is basically always replaced by the next one, and we tend to forget what these disasters really mean, like the tragedy and the suffering and all this. This is basically, we are consuming disasters, and the media is basically giving us the means of consumption. I was living in New York at the time, and I was basically witnessing 9/11 personally, and I was very shocked, like everybody else. But since my work is informed by disaster and destruction, I also was aware of the fact that I would have to deal with it on a professional level, because such a big event cannot just go unnoted and unclaimed for an artist that is mostly known for his work with disaster. And I had a piece before 9/11 that I did in collaboration with an American artist, Reynold Reynolds, which was called Apocalypso Place, which was a rather light and cheerful take on the idea of the impending apocalypse at the end of the millennium. We did it for December 99. And it was running through January 2000, kind of like this Y2K millennium change that turned out to be absolutely nothing special. And at the time, there were like a lot of end of the world movies coming out, movies like Deep Impact or Independence Day. And we used these movies already in Apocalypso Place because there was, it's a sitcom with people living in a completely destroyed environment, and they're watching TV and they're always watching disaster news that we created with a newscaster. And When 9/11 happened, we were invited to show the piece again in a biennial in Torino, which was curated by Michelangelo Pistoletto. And we decided that we needed to update the piece because now 9/11 happened and we witnessed actually the whole aftermath and all these newscasts and all this heroism. And it got really on our nerves, also this feeling of like United We Stand and the flags in the cars and stuff like that. So we wanted to do something that was critical, and we created this newscast based on the newscast of Apocalypso Place. That was basically the last news, the last time there would be a newscast. The idea of like having a newscast where live the end of the world occurs. And we used footage from these movies. So I had to do research in the video shops, especially Kim's Video that still existed back then. And I saw a DVD on the shelf that said One Day in September and featured this very famous enigmatic image of that terrorist with the hood leaning from his balcony. That actually is the only kind of like memory that I had, because it's an event that I was 7 years old in 1972. So I had personal memories of it. Of course, memories that were informed by television. But it's kind of like an event that has been long forgotten. And I was interested and I rented the tape, and then I decided that this should actually be something that will make my next solo show that was coming up in the fall of 2002 in Berlin. And I decided to make a piece called Black September with reenactment of the events of that day, the 5th of September 1972, and I put the opening of the show on the 5th of September 2002, so it was exactly 30 years later. And in the summer of 2002, I installed a studio, like a film studio, in the gallery that I was working with in Brooklyn. And the idea was basically that I would take all the news footage from the day that was in the film and that I kind of like stole from there. And I put together like a timeline of events that were on the TV that day. And I would show the other side of what the cameras were filming, basically the inside of the room where no cameras could reach at the time, and make some kind of like a fiction, but a fiction that is as close as possible to the reality. It was so close that I had scenes in the film where I have the terrorist basically going out of the balcony door in my footage from the inside, and then I cut and I take the news footage from the day where you see the terrorist coming out of the room onto the balcony. So I used this kind of like mix of archival footage and my own remake of the events. And that actually goes back to a piece that I made even earlier in 1997, which is called Feed Lucky Punk, and it's about holdups that are occurring in Hollywood movies, where I also used amateur actors and we used films like Selma and Louise or Taxi Driver or Natural Born Killer, and we made remakes of these events, but in a very kind of like easy punky way. That's why this piece was actually included in the previous two versions of the punk exhibition in Madrid and in Atrium. It's a piece that is also called Feel Lucky Punk. It's a quote from a Clint Eastwood movie where I improvised with my friends, and then we shot the remake, and then I mixed the footage from my remake with the original footage of the Hollywood movie. So I treated Black September exactly the same way. These pieces are very connected in a way, but Black September is really based on these real events that were very important for world history. And what is very special with Black September is the live footage or the live cameras were actually altering or influencing the events. So TV and reality basically went into a relationship of mutual feedback, because what happened was that the terrorist had a TV in their room, and unbeknownst to the police, they were actually able to capture the signal from the East German TV, because the West Germany, they wouldn't have that live on the TV, but the East Germans, they had that live, and the terrorists were actually watching live TV and were able to see how the police, for example, prepared for the attack. And then they communicated this, and they say, well, if you attack us, then we're just going to kill all the hostages right now. So they stopped the attack, which means that live TV basically completely changed the course of the event. So that was what I was mostly interested in. And so in the exhibition, I built two rooms. One is like a remake of the destroyed room as the police found it when the hostage takers and their hostages moved out, and a TV. And in the TV, you see actually the news footage that I used. And then in the second room, you have my reenactment. And in the reenactment, you see the hostages and the terrorists also watching TV. And what's happening on the TV in the projection and the other TV that is in the room, that's the same thing. So basically, that's the live TV that was so important for the event. So it's a very close-knit concept, and it's based on these pillars of how reality, reenactment, live footage, TV, and a certain degree of fiction are all intertwined. Because the thing is, I cannot know what exactly happened in this apartment. I can only guess. My work is basically an analysis of how we react and how we interact with media. So I'm very interested in these processes. And when I find something that works almost exemplary on a level like in Black September with the live footage, the feedback, how that worked, or in Feel Lucky Punk, where I have this surveillance monitor that is just a tool basically for the shop owner to put surveillance on his shop, and also to demonstrate there is surveillance, be careful, and I use these surveillance monitors in that piece, then in the exhibition, to basically show my remake. I created events that never happened for this monitor that was there to prevent or also to record this kind of event. So I basically fulfilled a prophecy, if you will. Like, finally, the monitor, it's a discarded monitor. Actually, I found two of those monitors, and they were broken in the way that the image of the shop was already burned into the screen from the usage, and that actually inspired me, but they were still working. And so I, for this ghostly space on the glass of the surveillance screen, I basically created these remakes of holdups that then finally happened in that monitor. Most of the monitors, they are just put up for nothing because there is never a holdup, but of course, there's always a holdup somewhere. So this recurrent theme of like almost a didactic display, monitor, projection, remake, reenactment, original, and then the mix of the remake and the original, and also the usage of the sound of the original for basically simplicity reasons. This gives me a way to demonstrate how some mechanisms within our perception of media may function, and just to basically reveal something that is maybe not so obvious. I think that analysis is kind of a big part of what artists should be doing. And for me, it's also a fun thing to reveal things like that, to peel just a layer off of something that I'm interested in and see what's underneath, what's the next layer. The way I deal with disaster is basically I choose to use humor and irony. And that's something that sets me apart already from the media, because the media usually is not allowed to be ironic when it comes to disaster, because it's something very, very serious. And if they want to continue selling their media, their newspapers, their TV shows, they cannot be cynical or sarcastic or ironic like I am. And I think that's my role as an artist. I can do that step and create this ironic critical distance to the event at the cost of being perceived as cynical. And I have been, it has been reproached to me that I'm profiting from disaster, that I'm insensitive and so on. But I think humor is a good way to put things in perspective, or at least to show it in a different light. So, for example, when I started to work with disasters, I used press images. That was in the early 90s, and I printed them onto jigsaw puzzles. Now, the jigsaw puzzle is, of course, a ludic kind of support. People are constructing a jigsaw puzzle. Usually, it's showing a beautiful landscape. It's a very slow process. And finally, when you are finished, you have this picture that you might put in a frame and then on your wall. And then you have, some nice mountains and a forest. And often it's a little bit kitschy and so on. So I took that support of the jigsaw puzzle and I used pictures from the press, very dramatic pictures from plane crashes, from train wrecks, from hurricanes, basically showing a maximum of destruction. And I printed them onto this support and I showed them as constructed jigsaw puzzles, with the idea of you construct an image and all you do is constructing destruction. I was attracted by this ironic paradox, basically. And also by the lightness of the support that kind of always reminds you of just playing and even children and things like that. But also the slowness of this symbolic reconstruction of an image that is so opposed to how a disaster strikes, where within seconds everything is just torn apart and pulverized and be fragmented. And so these paradoxes, they seem to work well for me. And I'm always kind of looking for these formulas where an idea basically works perfectly, the idea of the live TV and the projection in Black September, the idea of the disaster image on a puzzle. I also did then construct model disasters. So I started to construct big models, 100 square meter big models of miniature landscapes, kind of like these train things that people are building at home, but in my case everything is just completely destroyed, and then I photographed them and I printed them very big to get out of this notion of the model, to make some fake disaster, also with the idea of constructing destruction myself. And from that idea, I came to the idea of the sitcom at the end of the world, where there is this living room, like in a sitcom like Friends, with a couch, you know, or Seinfeld. The couch and beautiful young people, but they live in this completely destroyed living room, and they don't even care. They are affirmative. They love it. They love even the disaster. So it's this kind of like sarcastic take, where secretly I think, as much as we perceive disasters as tragic events, we also enjoy them, because we are the spared ones. We are the ones that have the privilege to like sit on the TV set and watch the suffering of the others, while the others have to do the suffering for us. And so there is always this discrepancy between the received and the receiver, you know, and we kind of like need that confirmation. It's life confirming to see other people die. If you want to simplify my method a little bit, I work with this kind of black and white, and I try to discover or to detect the ironic threads that are possible to insert into that subject matter, and sometimes at the price of maybe provoking people or hurting people, that can happen, and then I'm sorry for it, but that's my job. I think it was Georges Bataille who said that the only time when we really truly forget the fear of death is when we have sex, or when we feel desire. So when this very important other human feeling basically is able to momentarily push away the fear of death. But then I think death and sexuality are also intrinsically linked. So there is this connection, and maybe this fascination with disaster, if I would go into a psychoanalysis, would come out as an eroticized relationship to, you know, the idea of tragedy or drama or disaster in general. Who knows? But it's something that I think is in every human being. It's not just me. I think my fascination, my personal fascination with disaster, is more like a professional kind of almost a cold eye, you know. Like I started to analyze the idea of disaster, and I started to look out for disasters, and I started to read accident databases and like read up on plane crashes and make all these lists and statistics and made them also into elements that I used for my work. So it kind of like just piled up. I became a little bit of a scientist of disaster related issues, and I had to kind of like dig into the material, just because my ideas that I had at the time were calling for it. So had I had ideas about, you know, like flowers and trees, I would have investigated more about flowers and trees. But it so happens that I had this idea of putting disaster images onto puzzles, and that was really the first idea that I had dealing with disaster. And I think it was also kind of like circumstantial, in a way that when you start to do a research, one thing always leads to the next. So I had to go to like image banks, press agencies, and spend a lot of time just digging for these images that I wanted to use, and see how I could get permission to use them. And then I had to find out how I could find a puzzle support, and who could help me there. And all of a sudden, that was all I was doing. Especially then came the idea also of constructing the models. So I had like this huge studio in Brussels, actually in Schaarbeek, right there where the terrorists were putting together the bombs now 20 years later. And in an abandoned factory, I was working basically daily on this image. And it was an image also that kind of like triggered this all, because it was a Paris-Match that I found in one of those stores that sell magazines and records. So I would go for maybe record shopping, and then I would see the magazines, and then there was like this Paris-Match, and I put up the Paris-Match, and there was a double spread of like an incredible image of the aftermath of Hurricane Andrew with literally total destruction. And I was like, wow, this is very beautiful. How, like, this chaos, like, how is it possible that just literally everything on this picture is kaput, is broken? And I thought, this is actually something I want to work with. So I took the magazine home, and then I put it on a puzzle piece. That was one of my first big ones, like 8,000 pieces. But then I saw that also triggered the idea of building the model. And I built the first model that I made, which is called Catastrophe Number 1 from 1994, after this image. So it was a remake of the image. And here, this was the first time that I dealt with the idea of a remake. So I made a remake, whereas Catastrophe Number 2, which I made 2 years later, and Catastrophe Number 3, which I made recently in Vienna in a big factory, were fantasy disasters that I built just kind of like the landscape and the destruction. Everything came kind of like as I was building it, an improvisational disaster, if you will. But the first one was really a remake. So all of a sudden I became engulfed into this kind of material. Then there is a project that I haven't mentioned yet, and that is very important in my biography, that came at the same time or a little later, because then I was just spending way too much time in that ugly studio in Schaarbeek, very cold studio in the winter, and I was like, I need to get out of here, and I need to find a project that lets me travel. And it was just that year when the first World Trade Center attack happened in 1993. There was a bomb in the basement, and that caused considerable damage and killed about six people. And I was like, hey, I'm almost 30 now, and I was never in the U.S., and the World Cup was coming up. It was 1994. And so I was like, okay, I'm going to the U.S., and I'm going to all these places where disaster happened, like Hurricane Andrew, the place I was working with, this first one, the World Trade Center, and I'll find other places, you know, Los Angeles, Mount St. Helens, 3 Mile Island, all these places. And I go there and I photograph them now, like a tourist. I'm just going there, sometimes only months later, sometimes years later, and I photograph the place. And then I do kind of like a documentary photo project about these places. And that's a project that became known as a Voyage Apocalyptique, that I published many times. It's a very quiet project. You only see landscapes, and the landscapes very rarely reveal any traces of disaster. Usually it's just an idyllic landscape, and that's it. And then I also print the name of the place, the date. And when I show the project, it's maybe 20 or 30, or maybe even I'm not now at almost 100, actually, and it's all around the world. So it lets me travel, and I was in Japan for it. I was in the US for 3 months. And even though it's very distant and I'm coming very late, I'm still trying to get in touch with the people there and trying to have a conversation, you know, like tell them, look, I'm coming to Lockerbie because of the plane crash. And I came actually to Lockerbie in exactly 1 year after 9/11 in 2002. It was just after I opened the show in Berlin. I had a show at the Liverpool Biennial, and I went to the Liverpool Biennial set up. And then for September 11, I went to Lockerbie, where this Pan Am jumbo jet was bombed down by Libya. And I met a guy there who was also visiting because it was September 11, and because he thought that was the right date to come to this place now. And he was actually a police officer who was involved in the rescue operation afterwards, which only means rescue, means like collecting body parts. And he said he was still so traumatized by what he saw that it completely changed his life. And only now, I mean, that was the disaster happened in 1988. And we are now in 2002. Only now he was able to even come here and kind of like pay his respect to the victims of the disaster. So this project that was seemingly the most distant of them all, just landscapes and no traces of disaster, actually brought me the closest to the disaster, because still, when you go there physically, you feel this presence, and when you talk to the people even more so. And all of a sudden, it's not something reported by the media anymore, but it becomes something quite intimate and quite personal. And it taught me a lot about dealing with disaster on a much more human scale, and also about the idea of empathy with the victims and the people who really suffered and experienced these disasters. So it's a kind of like a serious project, even though there's a certain, I would say, subtle irony also in the fact that somebody would photograph these disaster places so much later. Well, Tsunami Architecture was basically a film project that was based upon this idea of voyage apocalyptique. It had to do with my personal life. I'm together with a photographer and filmmaker who is also an artist, Heidrun Holzfeind, and she, in her work, works a lot with architecture and modernism. And we, in 2009, living in New York, had a child, and who was born in New York, and then she was still working on a big project about Mies van der Rohe buildings in Newark, New Jersey, that she showed at Bard College. And then I was still working at the studio, but since we had a child now, we kind of like had to share these duties. You know, like once you look for the child and she goes filming, and then I go to the studio and she looks after the child. And like more and more we grew a little dissatisfied with this situation. Child was still too small to put it in a daycare, and we thought, well, we have to kind of like find a project where we can just take the child and travel with the child. It was just 5-6 years after the Boxing Day tsunami of 2004, and I came up with the idea of doing a trip to all these places that were basically afflicted by this disaster. And it was a very big radius because it was one of the biggest earthquakes in the history of the world, one of the biggest tsunamis. And so there was Indonesia, Sri Lanka, the Maldives, India, Thailand, Malaysia, and these were all places that were within the radius of this disaster, and at the same time places that I've never visited before and I was very interested in visiting. And so I came up with the idea of doing a film about the tsunami. And then since we wanted to do it together, we discussed it and we said, well, it would be interesting to see what's the post-tsunami reconstruction situation. How were these people like resettled, and what are the new dwellings, and how did the donor money be spent and changed the fabrics of the society and so on. So questions that are really recurring in Heidrun's work more than in my work. But I was also interested in learning something about this documentary approach. And so we decided to write something up and presented it to a museum that was just doing a group show about something that was connected, and the museum was very interested, and they promised right away some production money. So we basically, as a team, as a family team of three, we went there, and our son learned how to walk basically during that trip. And it was great to have him there because people in Asia are just crazy about children. And when you come as a small family with a little child, it's a complete different axis than if you just come as a film team. A reenactment is always, in a way, a fiction. And so I'm pretty loose and pretty open to, you know, my intuition. And I have pictures of the original room, and it bores me to use them to exactly reconstruct the room. So I only took the elements that were most important, the beds, the radiator, the suitcase on the radiator, the red chair. And the rest is kind of like up to me. And it was for me fun, again, to do some research, to find original objects from the time and also from the Olympics, like magazines. I'm careful to put only objects that could have been in the room, like a magazine, a live magazine that came out before the Olympics, but with pictures of, like Mark Spitz, for example, who was a big star back then. The four bullet holes in the wall, that is the most forensic kind of element. Yes, they exist in the original pictures. So it's something that I transposed, but I'm not going with a ruler to see how far they're apart. And I just punch four holes in the wall, and that must be enough. I'm quite ludic in that way, and I approach it a little bit like, I would say, a film director that wants to create an atmosphere rather than have something completely, like I'm in that way, I'm not a documentary filmmaker, I'm really a fiction producer of fiction.
Television knows no night. It is perpetual day. TV embodies our fear of the dark, of night, of the other side of things. Jean Baudrillard.